One. All right, so Ryan, Allie, welcome back to the show. I got Chris here with me for Zombie Squad cast, and Allie, a filmmaker, actress, and Ryan, actor in New York. And Allie, you're still in the DMV, right?
Yeah.
So let's go alphabetical, I guess. Allie, tell us a little bit more since the last time you were on the show. Give us a little update about some of the productions. We were chatting a little bit offline. You're kind of back on set, back on some virtual stuff.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm doing lots and lots of voiceover. So I got a lot of international clients right now. Lots of commercials there and lots of, I just did a rave commercial for Estonia.
Okay.
Forgot about raves, but now I never remembered. Let's see. I did a couple like virtual performances last week and I'm back on set. Just a walk-on for a feature last week and then did interviews production side this week. In rehearsals for this cool, wacky virtual show that's going up in November, and then it'll go on stage in New York once New York clears up or whatever. It's called The Change and it is dark and wild and it's not like a typical Zoom thing. Like I thought it was weird during rehearsals, but starting watching it, I'm like, oh wow, this is actually really creepy. I wouldn't want to watch it at night by myself in the dark. So, and my documentary is still gathering footage and I've been doing some weird stuff that I'll maybe tell you about later. It's real
Okay.
bizarre with my own filming.
Yeah. So this is that documentary you were talking about last time you were on, right?
Yep. Still chipping away.
Typically shooting stuff
As
here and there.
documentaries go.
Ryan, so you're still in New York, still acting. Tell me what. So I think I sent you a text after you were on the podcast. Were you in that HBO show with the stewardess, the
Yes,
flight attendant?
the flight attendant. Yeah,
What
it was on
was that? What was that show
the
called
flight
again?
attendant.
The flight
That
attendant.
that's what it was called. Oh,
Yeah.
okay. Kelly Cuoco or something from
Yes, Kelly
the flight
Cuoco. Yeah.
attendant. Yeah, so me and the wife, we binge watched that, and then I saw you and I was like, I know that guy. I've done shows with that guy. I've done productions with that guy, and I had him on the podcast. And my wife's like, no, that's not him. And I showed her the episode on YouTube,
A
and she's
really good
like,
show. I think I watched the whole thing in 2 days.
yeah. So well, so you were in that because I saw it myself. And I mean, what else since the last time you're on here? Back on set, some virtual stuff, classes.
Well, that was the last thing I filmed before lockdown. We actually filmed, if I remember correctly, I
Okay.
think we filmed that on a Friday, and lockdown in New York started on Monday, that Monday. It was crazy how quickly everything happened. So since then, what have I done? Obviously, not a whole lot last year. I worked on a film in Maryland called Jack Be Nimble that I believe they're editing and getting ready for by Steve Ouellette, getting ready to release, but I don't have any kind of date on that. And then I did came back to New York. I was really debating, so my lease was up over that summer. So I was like, I want to spend, New York rent for another year if the whole industry is going to be shut down or what. But I really love it up here. I like the neighborhood that I'm in. And if I left, I might not get it back. If you never know. Real estate up here is insane. So you got to stick with, if you have something you like, you stick with it. So I decided to stay in New York. I got a new management team. I'm with Jago Ciro Entertainment now. And they got me a job. The first job back was one day on the one of the spin-offs of the show Power. It's on Stars. So they're doing, I believe they have two spin-offs going right now. I'll be in an episode of Book Three, Raising Canaan, it's called, which was really great just to get back on set. And the way, I don't know how, especially down in the DMV, but like the way that a lot of the SAG productions are handling COVID has really made me feel better about getting back into it. I had to test so much. And then we got pushed back a week. I still had to test like 3 days that week that we were pushed back. And they were just really on top of everything. And it was a great shoot. Worked with a rapper named Joey Badass, who was so cool to work with, really fun. Gave me a nice picture and shout out for my son that's a fan of his and stuff like that. other than that, writing, getting back into acting classes, still all over Zoom, but just trying to, you know, get back to normal of networking and working on a couple of different writing projects.
So offline, you were mentioning this training. We were talking about how, you know, you're an ex-cop doing those crime shows, especially, you know, those Who Killed Jane Doe or Evil Twins, Nightmare Next Door, that Sirens was producing in the DMV. And, but then you're also an ex-cop, and that has like an added psychological effect on you acting, whether you're the bad guy or the good guy. And then you also mentioned this training or this class you took on sexual predators, sexual.
Yeah,
predators.
It was, this was back in like the 90s. This was the first year or two that I was a cop. I took a week long, I tried to take as many of the specialized trainings as we could just to educate myself. Mm-hmm. But I took one on child sexual exploitation. It's probably the same class. They just call it something different now, but it was a 40-hour, 5-day class. And, yeah, man, I really thought, like, you know, I'd love to lock those guys up every day, but sitting through that for a week, I just knew I could not deal with those kind of criminals day in and day out and those kind of stories without it really affecting me to the point that I didn't feel like I should, I would have complete self-control and composure in just dealing with some of those suspects after a while.
Just keep it simple. Drive a squad car. Just keep it simple. patrol the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I worked out of a school for a while, which is great.
But I mean, I was never a cop, a civilian cop, but I have the military background, and Allie knows I've always utilized my military police in the National Guard. So that's always been like, you know, kind of part-time, but utilize that as my acting class and as my way to connect, because that's all I really ever took was law enforcement military roles. But you as like a full-time, like you did it for, you know, 24/7 as a full-time job, and then utilizing that into your work. What pops up in your head as far as connecting to the character or the method acting or what have you, or the psychological, you know, kind of delving into the characters?
Yeah. I feel like it was great training for acting. I knew I wanted to be an actor before I became a cop, but I didn't realize, I figured being a cop would be really good for police roles. And it is, and it's a great thing to get my foot in the door with casting directors. But bigger than that, partially just the way I was raised, the way that I went about being a police officer was with a very empathetic outlook, as opposed to, it's really easy when you're in those kind of jobs to go one or two ways. And the most common way, I think, is people tend to put up walls and try to protect themselves from the things they're seeing every day. And that's just not how I relate to people. So I would always try to put myself in the shoes of the victim, even in the shoes of the potential suspect or whatever, because you can't really fix problems if you don't make an effort to understand them. And I think the years of doing that, especially when I was working with high school kids and got to really get to know them, and we're working on something, get to follow up with them and really learn about them. The years of doing that gave me an ability to really tap into that empathy, which I think is so important to acting, and to not judge the characters and just really, you know, take your ego out of it and put yourself in that position of this character, person that is living these circumstances and making these decisions that, you have to, if you can't figure out why they're doing that stuff, then you have no business playing that character. So I think in that sense, being a cop was a huge help to me. And I think people in jobs like that, police, nurses, military, all those things can benefit so much from learning how to act, from taking acting classes, because it sort of gives you permission to feel things that you kind of have told yourself and been told, don't feel that. Don't do that. Don't let that bother you. But it gives you that little window into that. And I think that's super healthy.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just, like you said, it's a tool. It's a window. It's, you know, like a psychological, emotional experiment to kind of like let loose some aggression or frustration.
Or... Yeah, and if I hadn't been a cop, I mean, there's so many lifestyles and just like ways that people live and go about their lives that I saw because I would have to go into these homes and these neighborhoods and stuff that I never would have had access to if it weren't for that. And I think when it comes to being a cop, it's all about how you go in that into that situation is exactly how much you're going to get out of it on that level. If you go in, you know, if you go bull rushing into a situation and start yelling at everybody and telling them to shut up and sit down, you're not really going to learn a lot about it. But if you look somebody in the eye and say, all right, tell me your side of the story, I want to hear it, makes a huge difference. And it was very, very healthy for me because I didn't get into a whole lot of fights from using that approach.
Yeah. And yeah. And Chris can tell you, Chris, and MC Techfall, Chris Page, you know, he's a DC firefighter now, but former Navy. And so like I mentioned with that couple of those episodes of those crime shows where I would just call him and say, hey, can you be available? You know, even though we're playing US Marshals and he might take some of those little synapses of being a firefighter, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I can definitely relate to, you know, you being a cop in the situations, because you definitely gotta kind of walk soft sometimes because you never know what you're gonna walk into. Because there's a lot of these, like we do a lot of welfare checks, you know, to check on family members and whatever have you, whatever's going on. A family member might call and say, I'm worried about another family member, can you check on them? But, you know, you got to go into that situation with situational awareness, you know, and protect yourself because, you know, there's been situations where EMTs and firemen have been shot. Yeah. We're doing a welfare check, you know, guys behind the door with a 12-gauge shotgun. So you just got to be careful on the situation and talking to people. You know, there's certain ways to approach people and talk to them.
It makes all the difference.
Very hostile, depending on how you talk to them. But if you talk to them in a calm manner, you know, they're usually pretty cool on how you approach the situation. But if you're very aggressive toward them and then they become aggressive towards you, it could be kind of scary. Like I've seen, and I work with a lot of cops in DC. Like we work hand in hand, brothers in blue. So I've seen different cops come with a different approach, and I've seen other cops come with a more aggressive approach. So it's kind of crazy how you see different people interact with different people. Like I try to come with a calm approach. You know, I'm here to help you. I'm not here against you. I'm here to help you. I'm here to assist you.
Which surely should be the intent of every police interaction.
Yeah. But you're telling me you come with a calm approach.
I come with a calm approach because I'm there to help.
I don't know you. I don't know you. I've never known you to ever come with anything with a calm approach. So I'd love to see that side of you on that job. So MC Techfall, what's new with music? What's new with comedy? What's new with
music? I've been working a lot as a firefighter, EMT, working 24-hour shifts. When I do have the time, I do, you know, dabble into music production and try to work on some tracks that I have been working on that are coming out in the near future. Some of them are experimental, some of them are EDM, some of them are hip hop. So I do have a few tracks in the works and still learning my craft. There's always new stuff to learn and new programs and VTS programs like we talked about before. And I have an electronic drum kit that I'm working on syncing with another music program and getting that situated so I can just keep learning new stuff. You know, just like any craft, you know, you still have to learn even actors, you know, like he said, he's taking acting classes and there's all, I mean, I feel like the pandemic has just opened up a whole new realm, you know, all these different artists are coming out. There's way more comedy clubs popping off online. Like so many people that have been working on their comedy during this whole quarantine. Like, now it's an opportunity to utilize some of the material that you've had written, you know, and broadcast. Like, what have you been doing over the quarantine, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of comedies, a lot of comics are coming out. Like, even new comics, you know, the people are just like, oh, I want to do stand-up. So they've been writing all their material down and fine-tuning their material, so ready to broadcast it to the world on stage. So there's so much comedy that I'm like baffled, you know, of how much has been evolved. And like, there's so many like clubs that are opening back up, and you know, new music being produced. It's just, it's awesome that people have taken advantage of this opportunity, locked in place, and you know, just to work on your craft is amazing. Just learning new stuff and just being online and doing tutorials, and just, it's awesome. It's pretty, it's good.
So, and Allie, and so coming back to Allie, you do a lot of comedy, and right?
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting listening to talk of, you know, a field that I'm not in, which is law enforcement or emergency rescue, but humanitarian clowning, which I do. And I just like listening to this, I'm like, oh yeah, it really is like compassion. Like, compassion seems to be like the common thread of like understanding people. And as actors, like, definitely when you play a dark character, you have to love what you do, and you have to have some kind of love there, you know what I mean? In order for the audience to root for your demise or root to support you. But yeah, so interesting. Yeah, I do comedy, mostly sketch. I like the idea of stand-up, but I'm not that quick-witted. And when I write jokes, they're like long form. So I'm like definitely more sketch and more sitcom-y for sure. Currently though, I'm writing like a dramatic piece. Like, my screenplay right now is like really dramatic, so it's not quite comedy, but I love comedy. By the way, Dave Chappelle's supposed to be in town, just to mention.
Yeah, but my comedy is more focused on like my experiences in life. Like, going through a Chick-fil-A drive-thru was like an experience of itself. So I wrote up a little comedy bit on just my experience of going through a Chick-fil-A drive-thru. You know, just like, or just waiting in line at Starbucks.
Yeah. And just
experiences that I have on a daily day basis that other people can relate to.
And they never get your name right.
Going to the airport in Atlanta was just like, it was mind boggling, you know, because I haven't traveled in a long time. And that was the first time I traveled outside of COVID, you know, and it's like, does anybody even work here anymore? Getting to get food at a certain time, and the lines are ridiculous, even to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah,
you know, you wait for 2 hours to get a cup of coffee while the vending machines are all gone. It's just crazy how we're in this, the aftermath of the pandemic is what we're dealing with. And I kind of take that into my comedy and my experiences of life and put that into, you know, a skit or a bit.
I just wanted to like ask a question about like your comedy writing. Like, for me, I just like look at my life and I'm like, it's kind of boring, right? Because I was there throughout the whole thing. So I'm like, but like, I had an experience where I was in a parrot costume and I locked my keys in my car during the snowstorm and had to wait for like the locksmith. And I'm like, someone was like, that sounds like it could be really funny to write about. And I'm like, it just kind of like happened. So when you're talking about these things, like, how do you get yourself to be like, that is so funny?
Like
how do you perk yourself up to be like, yeah, I'm going to throw that one out there?
Like, I just kind of, like, my experience, like, I take a lot of experience of my life. Like, I did a bit that me and Glenn filmed it, but I just didn't like that what we did on it. So I went back and I saw the video and I fine tuned what some of the parts that I liked about it, because I used to live in the hood. Mm-hmm. So that was the bit. I was like, just my experience of living in different neighborhoods.
And in Baltimore, I mean, Ryan, you were a Baltimore cop, right?
Baltimore County, though.
Probably Baltimore County. But, yeah. So you might appreciate this.
Adjacent.
Like, yeah. Been in these seedy neighborhoods and just taking what my experience was from living in these different neighborhoods. And I had a lot of friends that lived in other seedy neighborhoods. And I just kind of took bits of living in these different neighborhoods and kind of, and my experiences of being a fireman and working in the hood and stuff like that. And I just kind of jotted down, made a little sketch of like all the experiences and just kind of tied it in and just had an opening, a middle, and then just closed it out, you know? So those experiences were funny to me. A lot of them were comical, mm-hmm. you know, some of the experiences, and some, the audience may relate, they may not relate, but they have a better understanding of what it's like after my bit.
Well, I think the big thing that Chris does is he'll go to open mics and he'll just tell his stories. Mm. And, you know, if someone's filming it, he'll see what gets pops and he'll see what doesn't. And then maybe he'll watch himself and see how his delivery is. And then a lot of times me and him, I've filmed him like this one thing. And for me, the best joke out of the whole hood thing, and I think, Ali, you might have seen this in DC, but I'm pretty sure, you know, Ryan, you've seen this, is his, and his, I don't know, I hope you don't mind me, you know, saying your joke, one of the best jokes of the whole bit was, you know, you're in the hood if on one side of the block they're shooting a music video and on the other side of the block there's a funeral.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that was right?
And I think if even if you don't live in the hood and you're just driving through, you've probably seen that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's like, but my whole thing was like, I'm confused. Is the music video part of the funeral, or these,
or
two-
is the funeral part of the music video?
Can't tell. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But again, you know, like there's, you know, like with a lot of comics, and the best comics, and the best comics have always gone to an open mic and bombed.
Yeah.
And they've gotten one laugh, and they're like, okay, that's the one freaking joke that got a laugh. What was funny about it? Was it my delivery? Was it the joke itself? Was it the story? Was it the punchline? I mean, I remember seeing Seinfeld and that whole episode where he had a tape recorder. He put a tape recorder in the back of the comedy club, and Elaine grabbed it and started whispering, you know, like, you know, freaky nasty stuff into the tape recorder. But as an artist, I picked up on the fact that he's got a tape recorder in, and he even explained it. I have a tape recorder in there, mm-hmm. to record the whole set. And then, you know, I go back and I see what gets pops and what doesn't. And now, you know, me and Chris, we would go to clubs and I would just set up an iPhone and I would film his whole set. And we went to an open mic in New York once. He's done a whole number of open mics in Virginia, and he would just record it, mm-hmm. and then you go back and you figure that out, and that's the scariest, toughest part, is going in there with a bunch of people that don't know you from Adam. It's an open mic, they're drunk, and they're probably going to shit on you, but you got to take those hits, you know, to work on the material. You know, going back to the you said the compassionate clown,
humanitarian,
mm-hmm. humanitarian clown work. Yeah. I remember we were talking about that the last time, and you have to be extreme. There's a whole nother level of being extremely careful with this person's situation or what have you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of finding yourself. It's a lot of like being very present with somebody and really, you really learn to listen. And you play whatever game they present to you. I like using the example that a friend of mine, when he first started clowning, his first trip to a hospital with kids with terminal illness, and he wanted to be funny. And that's like the worst thing you can want, is to like be funny. Like, that's the worst thing as a clown you want. What you want to do is learn what the game is. And then the comedy comes. So he showed up and this kid didn't want him to come in. And he was like, he's trying all this stuff, trying to be funny. And the senior clown who was kind of like mentoring him was like, just go out of the room. The kid wants you to leave, go out of the room. But then count to 10 and come back in. And then if he sends you out, let him send you out. So what it created was he'd come in, the kid would send him out. He'd come back in, the kid would send him out. He'd sneak back in, the kid would send him out. And suddenly what happens is there's a game happening. The kid's having fun. The kid suddenly has controls. And like in the prisons, it's the same thing. It's like you're able to get all these prisoners together. Those are really fun because they're very, there's like nothing to hold. They don't have any, they're able to just drop down their guard and play full on. But again, like when you get with the teens in the prisons, you got to figure out what the game is. Like, because they're like, clowns, not cool. I don't want to look uncool around my other friends. And so you kind of
have- Especially in prison.
Yeah, in prison, yeah. And, but you kind of like, what you learn to do is like, one technique I have with especially like adolescent teens is like, I'll show up and I'll be like, I'm going to hang out and be cool with you guys. And then they're like, they're just like, that's right next to me. Like, I don't want to be near that. Like that's thing is that vibe's still there. And suddenly that's a new game. And with hospitals, sometimes somebody, like I remember a moto taxi driver I was with and he, all of everything was broken. He didn't know when he was going to get out. And so you just, and he can't really laugh and stuff. So like, you sit and hold their hand, they cry and they talk to you, or you know a baby's gonna die, or you know this, you know everything around it is happening, but you just kind of like record it. You can't like take in these categories and labels. You're just present with a person while you're there. When you leave, there's a whole like wash of like, holy cow, that's super intense. That child was sex trafficked. This situation is really dark. You know, like all of this stuff starts washing over you afterwards. So there is a, the reason why you don't acknowledge that while you're there is because then you're making it about you. And it's all about your therapy to yourself. You should take care of yourself when you leave, but while you're there, you're just there to be with a person and let them really be themselves without having all those labels that people naturally start putting on them when they interact. So it is a lot of like, you have to be compassionate with yourself too, but yeah, it's a lot of category, like switching things on and off throughout the whole process. Yeah, I've been doing that with Patch Adams for about over 13 years now.
The real Patch Adams, right?
Yeah, 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 he's alive. Everyone always asks me, isn't he dead? I'm like, no, Patch is not dead. He's like 73 now. If I get this wrong, I'm going to get in trouble. I'll largely on me. And he's like,
he's in his 70s.
Yeah. 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 And he's, okay. He's tall, very tall. So if you watch the movie Patch Adams, Robin Williams was short. Patch is like 6'3 or 6'2, something like that. Maybe he's taller than that too. He's giant, long hair, one half's blue, one half's gray, usually in a braid. He just got one foot amputated, so now he's got like a little peg leg. We're stoked about the jokes. We get to play with that.
But what's funny is he's open to that, right?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. Patch has already made plenty of jokes. His son, who I'm close with both of his sons, but Lars, the youngest, sent some pictures and made some jokes about it. I mean, you know. It's good to embrace that and find some fun with it. I have another friend with a peg leg and his siblings used to take his leg under the table when they were teens. Lots of jokes there. But he's also really fun about it, you know, kind of.
Did you study clowning before you started doing this?
Yes and no. I didn't go to clown school. I didn't go to like Del Arte. My dad did mime when I was a kid. Okay. So I trained with him a little bit, and then there, Dodie DeSanto used to teach at the clown school, like Barnum and Bailey, and then she's also a student of Lecoq and went to circus school in France, and she's in the DMV, and so I've studied with her a bunch, and then I've just done lots and lots of movement, and I'm naturally compassionate, and I'm willing to throw myself into situations I don't know.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I took a clown class at the conservatory I was in up here.
Oh, cool.
And of course, going into it, it was just part of the curriculum. And a bunch of us were like, how are we doing clown stuff? Like having no idea, but it was the French style.
Oh, yeah.
And could not believe how helpful that was to straight acting or comedic acting or anything. But just having to be that communicative and play those games that you talked about and get this whole thing across and do this whole thing without being able to vocalize anything was such a huge learning experience where I have a lot of respect.
Oh yeah. 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 It is definitely a really fun. And I think, you know, it's difficult because I might've said this last time I was on here, but like when Barnum and when the circuses got bigger, the clowns got scary. Like what happened was suddenly you have these huge tents and you're selling out, but you have a nosebleed section. So the clown costumes got bigger and brighter and huger.
Garish.
And kids are usually at the front row. And so all that stimuli is suddenly right there. So I'm sure Stephen King, when he was sitting up front, was like, oh my gosh. And then it came about. Right. And so like the US's relationship with clowns is much different than, you know, it France, kind of changed the story, but like Europe and like South America, clowns are like, cool. Well,
people are very frightened by clowns. They have nightmares.
Yeah.
Yeah. My wife has a fear of clowns.
And yeah, I have some friends with that. Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I don't remember as a kid, I'm probably the oldest person on here. I don't remember people being afraid of clowns until after Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
Poltergeist. Oh, with a doll, right?
Yeah, and that clown doll in Poltergeist, and my sister had one exactly like it, and my cousin had one exactly like it. And I think that for a lot of people I know, that was like that first seed of, wow, clowns can be terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, and it's the costumes are crazy. Like, those costumes are crazy. I mean, like, when you look at, like, some of the older costumes, I mean, like, what I wear is, like, a nose, mm-hmm. and maybe there's, like, a little small little teardrop. I look more like a doll. You know, well, not like a Chucky doll. Let's get, like, if we're on the horror train. But you know, it's very subtle, and it's not very, nothing's very big.
Yeah, like in that class, we just wore the nose, and that was if you had the nose on, you had to embody what you were doing.
Yeah.
Also, remember that 80s movie Killer Clowns from Outer Space?
Yeah, and then they had like, that.
If there's so many of those, it just perpetuates.
Well, the novel It came out in 86, but then Poltergeist, I think, was 85.
I want to say Poltergeist was earlier than that.
Earlier than 86. Yeah.
Oh, like 81?
We're just throwing out numbers now. Really, if I guess, I would say 83.
Someone
changes
the internet.
It was scary. The very first Poltergeist.
82. Oh, yeah.
I've watched that movie too many. Used to come on Saturdays, like on rerun show.
We had it on videotape. My sister and I would watch it.
Oh my gosh.
Like, we went through a phase where we watched it every day after school.
Well, I feel like the second one was the one that was on TV all the time. It's always the sequels that don't do as well that ended up on
that TV. Old man was so good, but the rest of that movie was so good.
Oh, remember that little old lady?
Yeah. I think she's still alive, actually. Zelda Rubinstein, I think, is her name.
Oh, really?
If she's not still alive, she just died, like, in the last few years, I think.
Zelda Rubinstein.
Yeah.
Wow. 2010.
Okay. All right, well.
She passed in 2010. But
11 years, but still a lot longer than I was shocked to hear she was still alive.
They made three of those, I think, right? Mm-hmm. The third one was horrible.
Nobody talked about the third one.
It was never great. Chairs were moved, were flipped upside down in the movie. Yeah. And they came home to
listen. That first one, you know, Spielberg, you know, teaming up with Toby Hooper, the first one had special effects. Those were the days when those special effects looked real.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, the like, face peeling scene.
The face peeling scene was. And how that movie was PG with that face peeling scene, how Raiders of the Lost Ark was. PG with that face melting scene.
Well, they were both before PG-13 existed, and they weren't fed. Because I remember being a kid seeing PG-13 movies or PG movies that had boobs in them, and like we didn't think anything of it.
It wasn't until 80. Was the Big Easy PG?
I think the Big Easy was. I think the Big Easy was PG, but then I think Flashdance got R.
Flashdance
and my mom took me to Flashdance and then pulled me out during, I think, the strip club scene or
something. I don't even think there's any nudity in Flashdance.
There's a strip club.
There's
a strip club scene. It's the same scene where she splashes the water on her, but one of the other dancers that works at the strip club, I think, was topless. She pulled me out for that second, pulled me back in. But
you were at the theater?
I think I must have been like 4 or 5. My mom took me to it. Yeah.
My mom, I just like the image of your mom like walking through seats. Yeah.
Excuse me. You know, like I grew up with, and listen, I was a big fan of the Predators and the Rockies and the Rambos and the Terminators. You know, I was like a guy's flick guy. Mm-hmm. I was a guy's flick guy, except Staying Alive with John Travolta, Saturday Night Fever and Staying Alive and Flashdance and Dirty Dancing. And then guys are like, why do you know those movies? And I know them. I can sing all the Bee Gees songs in Saturday Night Fever and in Staying Alive. And it's because of my mom. She would show me all the dance movies. My mom was big into dance. She was a dancer. She was big into dance movies. And now she's obsessed with, you know, like, So You Think You Can Dance or all those dance shows.
But do you know the choreography too?
I could probably do a little bit of the dance at the end of flat of, well, I, yeah, who can't do Dirty Dancing? If you know, if you're drunk and horny, you can probably do all the dancing from Dirty Dancing. But I could probably do some of the moves. I can definitely do most of the moves from Saturday Night Fever. I can't do any of that Broadway dancing from Staying Alive, though. But
I just saw Flashdance for the first time maybe like 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I was just too young when it came out, never thought about it. And it's a good movie.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, this really wasn't just, hey, she's beautiful and got attention because of the song. Like, I was really like, this is an actually very good movie. Really enjoyed it. And she was great.
And this is Flashdance you're talking about?
Yeah, Flashdance.
And Flashdance always stuck with me. There was that line, if you give up on your dream, you'll die. Mm-hmm. Something within you will die.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, she like decided to quit that application to dance school, and that old lady that she went to talk to about dance and stuff died the day she quit. And that always stuck with me, you know, keep, you know, trying to like, you know, aspire and persevere with whatever it is your dream is.
That's the stuff that makes life worthwhile.
Yes.
Yeah.
Finding those things.
And like all these little, you know, crazy dumb stories that, you know, we're talking about here. It's like even through the struggles of sucking and failing and getting fired from a gig or whatever. And even more so, you know, kind of back to like stories and the stories we're telling and how comedy is doing now. I was actually going back with a lot of Spike Lee's productions, and he has written and directed a shitload of stuff I had no idea he did in the last 5 years. But it seems like he'll come out with a movie and then he'll come out with two or three little short form documentaries. And then these one-man shows, and you know he's also famous for having done the original Kings of Comedy, the original Queens of Comedy, but he'll do these one-man shows that I noticed. He directs. There might be a crowd. There might be an audience or a crowd. There might not be, but I don't know if you guys have ever seen Do the Right Thing. I can't remember this actor's name.
Oh my gosh, great. So good.
Great. So that. The actor who played the character with special needs apparently he knew Huey P. Newton was one of the founders of the Black Panthers.
Whoa.
And so this actor does like a one-man show, and it's the life and times of Huey P. Newton. It's not a documentary. It's not a narrative biopic on Huey. It's this guy who might have known him or might have, you know, I want to watch the watch this production to see what it is. But he's just telling the life and times of Huey P. Newton. And then, I, you know, maybe Spike Lee will superimpose graphics, pictures, documentary footage. Maybe.
Did Spike Lee do the Mike Tyson? I feel like he did directed the Mike Tyson one, which was
I think great. He did where Mike Tyson was talking. It was a one-man show of Mike so Tyson good. About Mike Tyson.
Was it called Undisputed? Was Mike Tyson
so.
Show?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was a Spike Lee joint. And, you know, he does a lot of these one-man shows. And if it's funny because it's tragic, or if it's funny because it's honest, then it's funny. Mm-hmm. But it's these one-man shows, and I think that's something that, you know, not and even, you know, Chris and Ali, there's these bits you could do in front of the camera, you know, still virtual or whatever, mm-hmm. and just talking about shit, and that yeah. will progress. And whether it's funny or whether it's emotional and inspirational, that's what YouTube's been doing a lot. A lot of people just go on YouTube and they tell these stories, and a lot of it might be comedy. A lot of it might be these motivational things, you know, like all these different motivational videos.
It's interesting that you were saying these one man shows, because you've seen the movie The Bronx Tale, right?
Oh gosh, such a good movie.
Where Robert De Niro was in it, but actually they did a live performance, which was a complete one man show.
It was
just the main character. Did the whole show. Buddy's character. And he did.
He did all the characters.
It was a Broadway show.
And back to Broadway, and then Spike Lee's been involved with John Leguizamo in his one-man shows.
That's
So good.
So good. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like Spike Lee directed Freak.
The was it Latin History for Morons? I think
Spike Lee did. Spike Lee directed too.
So good. John Leguizamo is fantastic.
Love that guy.
But there's those kind of experimentations that even I know it's been after YouTube, and I know it's been after new media that Spike Lee started to experiment. And so there's these, you know, things, you know, but going back to Ryan, Joey Badass, tell me about what was this gig with Joey Badass? Who is Joey Badass?
Oh, you know, honestly, I am not familiar with him. I'm not super, I like some hip hop, not like super deep into it. But I met my son is really into it. So I asked him about it, and he's like, he loved him. He saw him at this show in 2013, said he was awesome. But can't really say who he's playing in that show or what I did.
NDAs.
But he was just a really, really great guy to work with. I was very close with him all day. You can kind of extrapolate on my background and assume what might be going on. But just a really great opportunity to work with that whole cast and crew, and the director, everybody was just really fantastic on that. Plus it was the last day of shooting for the whole season, so there was just that cool energy where everybody was excited to be finishing. But you know, as all you guys know, when you wrap up a project, especially when it's been going for weeks, there's that sadness that's lingering right behind it as well.
Yeah, you know, going back to what Ali was saying about, as a humanitarian clown, you kind of just, you tread lightly in the room and see what the game that they want to play is. And, you know, this is our second four-way roundtable. Granted, I kind of told you offline, the first one we did, me and Chris, we knew the two guys very well. And I've worked with you guys, but Chris hasn't met you. You two haven't met each other. And so it was just very like your turn. As we started, it was very your turn, your turn, your turn, your turn. And then I kind of sat back and wanted to wait and see. Then the three of you started chiming in with each other, and I would chime in with each other and wait for that game. And I think that's, I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to like tell you guys, hey, remember to chime in with each other. I wanted to just see what naturally it comes of it, and that happened. And there's that natural progression of the game or the flow of that communication, that experience.
I love these roundtables, you know, because you get an opportunity to interact with different people on the show, and just like I love both you guys' ideas on and different perspectives on different topics, you know.
Yeah,
it's just. It's very cool to, you know, talk to different people, especially with these round tables.
Yeah. I mean, before, you know, the round tables was just me, Chris, and another colleague, Durko. And then I said, you know, let's kind of take that and experiment. And I really want to just see like, okay, listen, you know, the quarantine and the virtual and the remote and experimentation, people work thinking outside the box. And a lot of times it's just, you know, jump into the pit. And try not to, you know, like looking at Jackass, you know, the trailer for Jackass Forever is out and that old fuck Johnny Knoxville still getting hit by bulls because he'll jump into the bullpen and see what happens. And a lot of times, you know what the hell's going to happen. You're going to get hit by the bull, but you know, I'm excited for that. I mean, that looks great, but you know, I was talking to Chris, offline, Nick Cage has come out with a new movie called Pig, Oh, Chris, did you ever get a chance to check it out?
No, I'm still, that's still on my bucket list, man. I'd really want to check it out. I know about it.
Watching a movie is not on a bucket list. Watching a movie is not a bucket list item, man.
Like Nicolas Cage is doing an indie flick. Like, I mean, it's beyond a bucket list.
Nicolas Cage has been doomed to B-movies. Let's put it that way. I mean, back in the day, Ryan, you might be able to relate. Back in our day, we didn't call them indie movies, we called them B movies. You know, they were even the theater, or they were B
movies. Only thing that was called indie movies were those like really art house, like usually British movies or
British movie.
Super serious dramas. Usually there were very few.
Yeah.
Well, at least not things that were, I mean, looking back, like we know the business better now, I can see like a lot of things that I liked as a kid were indie movies that I like. La Bamba was an independent movie.
But you wouldn't have known it because it was in the theater.
And nobody called it that.
Because it was in the theater. It had a nationwide, full theatrical nationwide release.
Yeah.
And then come 99 and with the riot, with Swingers. Mm-hmm.
I think Tarantino was the big
Robert Rodriguez. Yep.
Yeah.
Robert Rodriguez and Tarantino. I mean, with Reservoir Dogs, was straight to tape.
Yeah.
But it won a shitload of stuff. Yeah. But it was straight to tape. Like they wouldn't even put it. They put it in select theaters. I think maybe. I mean, especially probably New York.
Oh
and
my gosh,
LA.
Select theaters. Yeah.
Remember that? there's no more select theaters now. It's just streaming platforms.
There was a theater in DC. I went to. It was a very small theater. It was on E Street, and there were very selected movies in that theater.
I know which one you're talking about.
It was only like the serious movies were in there. Like it was a couple of movies that had been nominated for Academy Awards.
Yeah, like movies like, you know, Angela's Ashes or, you know, movies with titles like Clementine or, you know, the Darkness Upon, like those type of freaking
titles. I actually saw Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels at the theater.
Oh, wow.
The movie theater?
Yeah.
And you couldn't
see it anywhere in Baltimore, and a friend of mine lived near D.C., so I really wanted to see it.
It's a very small theater. They serve beer in there, in that theater.
That's how independent.
It's adult films. All, like, serious films. There's no comedy films.
Adult films?
What my experience.
Or films for grown-ups? Adult films or films for grown-ups?
Good clarification.
Films for grown-ups, not like... This isn't Baltimore City.
This is DC. This is classier. This is DC, right?
Classier.
This is Chocolate City, not Charm City.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, but listen, even Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, that was kind of like the rise of the foreign independent film.
Yeah.
Because Lock, Stock was an indie movie, a low budget indie movie from another country.
And it was after, like, I think Trainspotting was another one of the big ones that sort of brought the UK cinema
like
to
Scottish.
Popularity here. Scottish. Yes, Trainspotting was Scottish. 94?
They actually made two, Trainspotting 2.
Trainspotting 2 is great. The original is one of my all-time favorite movies. And when I heard they were making the sequel at first, I was like, ugh. Then Danny Boyle was attached. Yeah. So I have all the faith in the world in Danny Boyle. I'm so bummed.
Sometimes
he's not doing that next Bond movie.
Yeah,
that's already filmed. But
so, you know, sometimes those return movies, those recap movies, like they did, they've done those before.
He said when the first one came out, BBC something, I don't know, but they offered him a whole bunch of money to do a sequel within 5 years, and he said nobody cares about these characters 5 years later. He said back then the only way I'll do it is we wait 20 years. And every single person agrees to come back. And that's it. They waited exactly 20 years. And because of that, it's a completely different story than the original, but it's still so true to the characters. And they did a great job. It's tough to do.
Yeah.
See that.
So, Ali, tell me, so going back to this documentary that you mentioned, and you're getting a little bit of snippets. So tell me everything that you can since the last time we chatted about this documentary.
Well, I started, I guess, 4 years now, documenting the Equal Rights Amendment movement within Virginia to become the 38th state. So I started with a grassroots group that was in a very, a rural area that was really effective with their bipartisan support of the amendment. And so I started with them and then kind of followed them through their journey and connected with like the regional reps of the campaign and followed them to Richmond and all sorts of law events. And just, it's so, it started with a friend of mine texting me at like 4 a.m. and being like, you don't have to be a lawyer to make a difference. And I'm like, oh yeah, I don't have, I could do something with this. And she's like, why don't you make a doc? And I was like, oh, that's great. And so she was like, yeah, we can do this. And then she moved away. And so then it was just me. So it's been a journey. I think I've got so much footage at this point. I've got a lot of footage and a lot of interviews, and it's been very fascinating. And we had a really great conclusion of it being ratified in Virginia and becoming the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. There's a lot of documentaries made. Like, it was like, I've been there for 3 years, and then like the last 2 years, like suddenly all these people rushed in, you know, with crews. And I was like, oh, okay. I think they're going to take a pretty standard, typical documentary approach on documenting this. So I've still been connecting with everybody. So I think I haven't put it together yet, but I think I'm taking a different turn and looking more at how one cause or one realization, how we're unaware of what our laws are, because they change from state to state. It's once you start getting into it, you're like, I cross the state border and it's over. Like, all of these rights I have vanquished. Like, they're just gone, evaporated. A good example is marijuana, right? Like, that's the easiest one to like use. You're like in DC, you go into Arlington, over. You know what I mean? Like, or you get on the Chinatown bus, you go up to New York and you're like, it's not here. Bizarre.
It is now.
Yeah, it is now. Yeah, it's same with Virginia. It's in Virginia too now. But just like the border crossing, there's all these laws that you don't even think about that exist when you cross, like that suddenly you're like, oh, my protection's just gone out the window once I cross the border. Most people, you know, you don't necessarily have to worry about it because people don't think about it and they forgot those laws even exist. But they exist, and it's like a wake up call. And I think what's really interesting is as people kind of like, we're like, oh, the Equal Rights Amendment isn't a thing. I did going into it. I was like, yeah, of course. Oh no, it's not. And then like this like realization, and then people going from not at all being involved in politics to suddenly being so motivated and so engaged. And it's been very fascinating to see how the community of average people have transitioned and changed and like kind of where they've projected themselves. And not just in politics, but like even artistically, like they started off with this campaign, they felt camaraderie, they felt a movement, they felt a drive. And some have like taken that into their art that they kind of put aside on a shelf and now have like developed it into all new sorts of things. It's just been really, I'm not sure. I don't want to do this documentary. Ken Burns, which I love Ken Burns. It's great. Love it. I love most documentaries, but I just want to do something different. I'm really into short too. I think I'm going to cut it up into like a series. And I think every episode is going to be 5 minutes. I don't want it to go past, like, I think I've mentioned this to you before. I liked the concept of Quibi. I like TikTok. I like things that are short. Our attention spans are like goldfish. Watch a 5-minute documentary, feel moved, just like a commercial, right? Yeah. We're moved by commercials all the time.
And that's the new media. I mean,
5 minutes is, next week. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And that's what this, even it's either good or bad. I mean, it depends on your perspective. It depends on your way of looking at things. I mean, still, I like the hour and a half to 2 hour long movies. But there are these 5 minute to 10 minute short, super short form, you know, products. That's
the way comedy goes too. You know, like you do a 5 minute bit.
Yep.
And that's how I like to do it, is a 5 to 10 minute bit on like say any topic that you want to pick, and you just go on a 5-minute rant on that topic, mm-hmm. just sell that and put it up on YouTube and see if people like it. If you're getting a ton of comments, you know, then do a full-fledged 45-minute to an hour show. Mm-hmm. But those little bits are all on YouTube. Even it's rarely that you see like a full-fledged comedy show, you know, that you don't have to pay, that usually you have to pay for it because it's been on some other platform like HBO, Netflix, yeah. Showtime. But a lot of them that you find are all like 5-minute bits.
But you know, Robin Williams just did this. I mean, he didn't just do it. Robin Williams did this stand-up comedy, I don't want to say like 10 or 15 years ago, you know, and this was the one where he was making fun of Viagra.
Oh yeah.
And he had the water bottle. He always had the water bottle on stage. He used it as a gimmick for that joke. But Robin Williams would tell a 5-minute story, and then he would tell a totally different 5-minute story. And then an hour later, his set's about to be done, and all those stories came together with this last joke that involved the punchlines from the other 5 jokes. And that was something that Steve Harvey and Bernie Mac and Eddie Murphy and, you know, Steve Martin were known for a lot. And you know, even Dane Cook, you know, everybody gets made fun of for liking Dane Cook back. Well, what year was that? People liked Dane Cook back in 2001 and 2000. 2000 from like 2000 to 2005. You know, he was using MySpace, you know, Dane Cook started jumping on the whole social media train and using MySpace as his way of, you know, promoting his shows. But he, you know, he had like all these different jokes, and then all those jokes on the last joke would all blend into each other into like this mega punchline. And so as far as like marketing, yeah, there can, that 5-minute joke can be a joke in and of itself. And you can even put that on TikTok, like, you know, a part of that joke can be on TikTok, and then that could lead you to a YouTube, and then that could lead you to the final, you know, hour and a half long project. But, you know, it's tricky. I mean, like, you know, again, new media with the rise, you know, YouTube came out in 06 or 07, and with the rise of new media just created 17 different forms and formats of the same thing. And if you like the shorts, because I watch YouTube probably more often than I do a movie. Sitting down and watching a movie from beginning to end. And I think, you know, in the last month, there's only been 2 days where I sat down and I watched 2 movies back to back, actually, from beginning to end. But like you were saying, but back to the independent films and you know, the B movies. Well, anyway, Pig, you know, Nick Cage. I don't know if anybody's seen Pig, but it's a must watch. I mean,
you know, I actually almost saw it last week.
It's a must watch. You should have watched it.
Yeah.
He's got his.
You can still watch it though. It's not gone.
I didn't miss it.
But what a career with this guy. I mean, I remember him in Honeymooners.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Right. And then he becomes this villain in Wild at Heart. And then there was the other one he did with Dennis Hopper.
I can't think of the name. I know which one you're talking about.
You know, he did a Lynch film, Wild at Heart. Yeah. And then he did that. It was a desert film, wasn't it? It was one of those. It was a desert crime film with Dennis Hopper. And then becomes like this huge buff tough guy. He's in Kiss of Death.
Yeah.
And then he gets the gig of a lifetime with The Rock. Now he's a huge action star. Gets, you know, the hair plugs. What?
He was Ghost Rider.
Well, okay, so hold on. Not yet. So then he's the villain in Kiss of Death, and then he gets that Oscar winning movie leaving Las Vegas. Now he's on billboards, and then he gets the action roles. And then he gets the Marvel roles, And then he starts doing the B movies, and then he goes back to that over the top thing that he was doing back in the 80s.
And he started off doing the silly comedies, silly-ish comedy. Like, the vampire one?
Vampire's Kiss,
I think. Vampire's Kiss. Yeah, that's
once,
right.
Once Bitten was Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah.
Vampire's Kiss. Gosh, I forgot about that movie.
And that's Jim Carrey's. That's so Jim Carrey's two Jim Carrey's preludes to Ace Ventura. Oh, yeah. In Living Color, actually.
Yeah.
I love In Living Color.
But yeah, I mean, Nick Cage always shoots his shot. Every whatever he takes, he is making it his, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, it got to a point where he wanted to experiment, and for some reason the filmmakers would let him, but he wanted to experiment with his performance and his character, his character development. Mm-hmm. And then he would do these B movies and he's over the top. And then a couple of directors decided, I'm going to embrace this ridiculous over the top Nick Cage with Mandy, Mom and Dad, and Color Out of Space, where the psychotic Nick Cage was a must-have. And then he does Pig, and he's back to that edgier, subdued, and intense, but internally intense. Mm-hmm. And yeah, well, I wish somebody had seen it. We can chat about it, but that's it's a must-watch. You have to check it out.
You should have given us the homework.
No, man.
That's
too planned, man. That's not experimental. Well, anyway, you know, going back to I want to Ryan, you can maybe help me out a little bit with what Maryland's okay, so if Virginia is a Commonwealth state, what Maryland's like, just a regular state? What's the
regular state, I guess?
Yeah, okay. Because like you were saying, Allie, you know, if you go from Maryland into DC and then into Virginia, and it's just totally different things. A lot of people don't realize DC is a federal entity, and you have so many different laws there. And then Virginia is a common. I mean, I was, you know, as a National Guard MP, I was working the gates at Fort Belvoir.
Oh yeah.
And you have, you know, your army laws there, and everybody preferred to get in trouble on base because the second you get outside, we were looking at like the freaking laws, the citations you could get for driving with a flat drive, just for driving with a headlight out.
Yeah.
There's like 18 different things you can get cited for because it's a Commonwealth state. And so that's where that's what funds that state, is just hemming people up.
Maryland is like that too. They're just not so bad.
Yeah. But Maybe not. Well, that was,
I was just going to say that was one of the things I always ethically objected to when I was a cop, was just that push to always write tickets and stuff. And I was just like, it's not our job to make money for the state. It's our job to make our area safe and make those people feel comfortable and happy. And well, I could get into a whole different tirade right now about my issues with that. But yeah, Maryland is just as bad. They'll find just as many things to jam you up with.
Yeah. Well, hey, we've come to the fun part. So this is like the ultra experimental part.
Okay.
You know, we tried this once before. We came up with something pretty good. So let's see. Chris, you know, I'll start with you. Come up with an object.
Any object. Okay. A car.
What kind of car? Be specific. It's got to be a very specific car.
A 1969 Plymouth Roadrunner. How about that one?
1969 Plymouth Roadrunner.
Classic vehicle right there.
All right.
Badass.
All right. 1969 Plymouth Roadrunner. All right. And so Ali and Ryan, you each come up with a character. Any kind of character.
Any kind of character or an existing character?
A character.
Okay.
Cam.
Okay. Billy the Kid.
All right. Billy the Kid.
I have to give them a name. Do they have to be real? Like when you said character, I thought you were going to make us act. So I was like, I'm ready. Let's go. I got one.
Talk about me, man.
So you want like a character that like
you're a character. You're a character enough. It can be a historical character. It could be a fictional character. It could just be like, you know, you could say fire. You could say like a job, like a cop or a fireman or something, sure. Like a character, but just any character, like first thing that comes to mind.
Harriet Tubman.
Harriet. So Billy,
literally okay. The first person that came to my head.
Harriet Tubman. All right, this is gonna be weird. All right,
you got Billy the Kid,
Harriet Tubman,
and employer.
Harriet Tubman. This
and,
is
all right. So Chris, really think now. Think of a location.
Tennessee. Tennessee.
Are you getting drawn to the South because of Billy the Kid and Harriet Tubman? All right.
Yeah, actually, I am.
All right. And so, Ryan, come up with a conflict, some sort of conflict.
Okay. Billy owes Harriet money.
Okay. Owes her money. So you know what? I should have done this like privately, like in a private text to all three of you, and like just start playing with like the best, because now we're all being, you know, directed in one direction based off of whatever. So, I know. And then so, Allie, come up with another object.
An object, sure. Yeah. A pogo stick.
Pogo stick.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So are we dealing with time travel here? We got a 1969 Plymouth Roadrunner.
I mean, if you can we go like magic?
right. So, all right. I think I know how to rework this experiment for the next show, but it's fine. Let me see here. So, you know, let's kind of work on this story. What happens here with, you know, in Tennessee, Billy the Kid, Harriet Tubman. He owes her money. He leaves her money in a case. That case, like that satchel of money, sits in the desert for mm-hmm. for 100 years. Harriet Tubman, 1869.
So
the desert in Tennessee.
Oh, so like what happens is Harriet Tubman has got like this message, right? And she puts this money and she buries it in a case, right? Because she's got to hide it because people are coming. She hides it. Billy the Kid in the future finds it, and he's not driving him. And he stores it somewhere, and someone puts it into the Plymouth. And someone buying the Plymouth has a pogo stick, and once tries to fit the pogo stick in the back of the car, and then finds the money or something like that. I don't know. I thought I was going somewhere positive, and
No, that's fine. That's fine. Billy the Kid's like great great grandson. William, whatever the fuck his name was.
Okay. Yeah, Bonnie. William. Rodney.
Bonnie.
William Bonnie. William That's Bonnie the Eighth. William Bonnie the Eighth or something.
Mm-hmm.
Finds, you know, has this, you know, inherited this, you know, 69 Plymouth.
Uh-huh.
Or, no, inherited a trunk. And then the trunk... So he loads the trunk in there and then
that's good.
You know, he's packing up, his kid's got a pogo stick and the kid's like pogoing around. Mm-hmm. They stop off on the road. Because Billy the Kid was out west, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't know.
Nevada.
Nevada?
And New Mexico.
Nevada. Okay. And
actually more New Mexico.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
The 1969 Plymouth Roadrunner was a time machine.
Yeah, it's the like
where the pogo stick at the time.
The idea from was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure when Billy the Kid went into the telephone booth and it was a time machine.
Yeah, and then you took some like Back to the Future there with the car. Yeah, I like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the 69 Plymouth has time traveling capabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the great grandkid realizes the wrong that Billy the Kid did and goes back to try to fix it, but instead goes to Harriet Tubman's time, meets Harriet, and goes, Oh, I'm gonna learn some things and I'm gonna wait, the money. We have, was money included in this? He brings a pogo stick to her.
That'll change everything.
Let's see. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, she could.
Car would do her way better.
Yeah, for real.
Okay, so if it's 1969 and it's one of the descendants of Billy the Kid in 69, money back then still like was made out of gold or silver or nickel, right?
In 69?
Yeah, 1969.
1969?
Yeah.
I don't think anything was still made out of gold or silver. I don't think so.
Money wasn't made on the gold standard anymore. Nixon did away with that, right?
I do not know. Oh, I thought you meant like the money that people, people exchanged was gold.
Well, the actual coins.
Yeah, I don't know
had
when like, that stopped.
Like a gold coin was made out of gold.
Yeah.
No. All right.
I think a gold coin is still made out of gold.
A gold coin is still made out of gold?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. All right. That's a good question. That's a good question for a whole nother discussion.
But I think paper money would have started back in her time anyway.
Yeah.
There was paper money back in her time.
But I think silver was probably more prevalent
There was Union currency and then there was Confederate currency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there was paper bills that were on, and then that back then the paper bills were on the gold standard. But also back then, gold coins were definitely made out of gold.
Yeah.
Now you have Billy the Kid's descendant. He's got this trunk. You know what? He's got the trunk. It's cash. You know what he's got? He's got a trunk full of loot. He didn't know that his great-great-grandfather, Billy the Kid, had.
And he wants to do good and repent. And then he goes to Harriet Tubman and gives her.
No. I think he gets stuck out in the desert.
Oh.
And like a sandstorm comes.
Because of a pogo stick person that is actually a time travel, like the guy in the coat in Bill and Ted. Okay. But okay. They're on the pogo stick.
No, I like that. Some fucking weirdo out in the middle of the desert coming down that paved road.
Yeah.
You ever seen Domino with Mickey Rourke and Keira Knightley? She was a bounty hunter. She was the model turned bounty hunter.
Mm-hmm. Mm,
Keira Knightley and Mickey Rourke and Christopher Walken. And holy shit. So many people are in this movie, Domino. And one of the best scenes is they accidentally get drugged and it's these desert prophets. I've always loved these desert movies with these desert prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a desert prophet scene. So like a pogo stick desert prophet.
Well, there's lots of hallucinogens in the desert. So you can see into the future a little better.
Yeah. Well, there's a sandstorm and he winds up in, he winds up and he has this and so like a lot like Back to the Future 3 where he had to hide the DeLorean in a cave. You know, he's got to hide this in the desert somewhere, and he makes his way to Harriet Tubman and gives him this trunk which just happens to have cash from the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
But wasn't she trying to hide the cash?
This is Billy the Kid's stash that his offspring has in 69.
We've scratched the her hiding.
Okay.
But when he makes his way back, this cash, this gold and these bills, I think are still usable in her time.
Okay.
Right?
Well, if it's gold bars or something, that would still be usable for sure, right?
Yeah. Yep. So he goes back and he like,
or it was the it was money she was trying to hide to keep from getting stolen by the Confederacy.
Uh-huh.
But the twist is he came back to give it back to her and he went too far. And that's the money that she wound up hiding in the first place. So it's a paradox.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, that's great. I like that. It's almost like Dark.
Yeah, and then nobody can use it because it's just stuck in that loop.
It's just in the loop. That music.
So how come it never got used? If he has the same amount that he gave her to use... And something happened.
She hit it.
Because she hit it.
Because then she had to hide it right away.
And then he keeps finding it. Where does this...
That is depressing.
and so then, of course, you have that moment you have that deja vu moment, like the movie Deja Vu with Denzel, where he started figuring out that he's stuck in that loop.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Or Groundhog Day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was fun.
Yeah, definitely. Like
this is fun. Well, I'll go back to this record. I'll jot some notes down and let's see. Well,
are you going to write a script from this and then get back to us and let us know?
Of course, I'll keep you. Of course, I will have you guys involved. Yeah. You know, but you know, this is just one of those. This was like that kind of new idea with these roundtables, just to see how that pans out.
Yeah.
What I think I'll do.
Put each person in a breakout room.
Well, I'll just send you a text before we go live.
There you go.
Give me the four. Give me the location, the character. Give me a location, character, object, conflict, and then I'll rip them up. I'll shuffle them up, and then I'll say, okay, here's what we got.
It's a good writing exercise.
Yeah.
It's
an improv exercise too. So I thought like Ryan, Chris, and I were going to suddenly have to do a scene. No. Here we go.
That'll be the six way roundtables that I start doing in a year, maybe. I don't know.
Dude, we're gonna build up to like a 20 man round table.
Like a whole conference. Everybody come up here, do a scene.
You like start it off on two man, three, four, five, six.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm gonna keep these notes, man, but also I got the record, so you know you never know what might come with this. But Ryan Thomas, Ali Sheff, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Chris, you know, it was a blast as always. And so, you know, guys, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. Ryan, give me some plugs, links, socials before I let you go.
Oh, I'm never prepared for this. I don't really have anything coming up right now, but my website is ryanscottthomas.com. Here's a plug, something I can plug that's not mine. But I'm working on I've written screenplays for 20 some years now. And I've got an idea for a series, and I've never done a series. And it's very different, to prepare and just lay out. So a good friend of mine, Jamie Nash, if anybody's familiar with the Save the Cat books, Jamie just wrote Save the Cat Writes for TV. And is fantastic in taking a lot of the same principles and just screenwriting principles in general and breaking it down into how you need to do a TV series conceptually, not how you need to, but a good roadmap. So I don't have anything to plug. So Jamie Nash, Save the Cat Writes for TV, highly recommend it.
Awesome. Ali Sheff, any links, plugs, socials?
Yeah. Let's see. I'm going to like look on the computer because I can't remember. There's a show I'm doing, the weird crazy one on Zoom. It's going to look like different than any Zoom shows you've seen. It's very creepy. It's very uncomfortable. Dark, well-written, great cast. There's actually two casts, by the way. There's like, so if you go one night, the next night you might have a completely different cast.
That's cool.
It's a different show in a big way. If you go to the show's called The Change. If you go to Bridget and you type out bridgesandbutterflies.cc /the-change. You can get tickets, you can check it out, you can see the rad poster. The other thing to promote someone else, if you have children, there's this really awesome book out called Pat on the Path. It's a learning book that a friend of mine just wrote that's pretty rad and amazing and awesome. If you want to find me, you can go to the @AliSheff, which is AliCheff. And my website is AliSheff.com. If you do a /voiceover, you can listen to my, you know, reels and stuff, fun things like that. If you want to listen to me, I'm out there in the world.
Awesome. Chris, MC, TechFall, Page, socials, links, plugs, as always.
Yeah, you can check us out at, on Instagram at Zombie Squad 211. You know, check us out on Dead On Pictures. That's www.deadonpictures. Check out some of our merchandise
You have right there.
Yeah, up top.
Yeah.
Got the shirt from Zombie Squad. Check it out. Nice. Best of the line from Cobra. We got a lot of new merchandise available on deadonpictures.com.
Yep.
Check it out. We have anything from t-shirts to tapestries to artwork to laptop covers
to mugs, coffee mugs,
pins,
stickers, COVID masks.
And watch out for, we just released some of the episodes from Rogue's Gallery, season 3. Check out the new one, Signal Man and Scorpio. It's awesome. Just watched it when it dropped. Big ups to Glenn Nelson. Big ups to Connor. Big ups to Melissa. You know, all the production that has been putting into it in the last year. Season 4 dropping next after season 3. Sinister Infinite coming out. So I'm really excited for everything that Zombie Squad is doing and Dead on Pictures. I love these roundtables. Thank you for making me a part of your roundtables. I love to interact with all your different guests. And just big out to Zombie Squad Cast. And we got big things going on in 2021. So just ring the bell, give us a like, and subscribe to our channel. We got a lot more episodes coming at you every week. And thank you, too, for being on the show. It was a blast having me on. It was fun.
I got to commend you. You look just like Stallone with the sunglasses. I see you've been lifting. You got the no neck look. Show the shirt.
You planned that, Chris? You were like, yeah. I'm just going to match today.
You need the matchstick, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of the toothpick, the matchstick. Well, guys, it was a blast having you on. We'll definitely do this again down the line. I want to make this a recurring thing. Don't go anywhere. We'll chat.
Viewers out there, if you want to become an honorary